In August 2018, legendary women's soccer goalkeeper Hope Solo filed a suit against the U.S. Soccer Federation for their violation of the Equal Pay Act and Title VII. What should have been a moment of solidarity, what could have been a precedent-setting victory, instead was the beginning of the end to a perfect storm. I spoke with pioneering sports lawyer Rich Nichols, who is the former executive director and counsel for the United States women's national soccer team, about his new book, All Things Being Equal, and his role in the women's historic and courageous quest for equal pay. It's a story not only about the way women are paid in soccer, but a wake-up call for women and girls, reminding us that when it comes to the way our work is valued in the world, the most powerful leverage we have in a negotiation is the way we value ourselves.
This is Rich Nichols, and this is a lesson on commitment.
What's your earliest memory of being creative?
My earliest memory of being creative was when I was probably 7 or 8 years old. I used to spend my Saturdays at the public library. I would go to the library and be there all day. And around 8 years old, I started writing like short stories. And I would cramp myself up somewhere in our tenement where we lived, and I would just write. I just write short stories. 8 years old, I started to be creative.
I love it. And is that when, because teachers recognized you as smart and you were teased for being smart?
Yes. Yeah, about that time. And they would sit us at the, if you were smart, you'd be seated at the front of the class. Mm-hmm. And for me, I was smart and I got picked on a lot. I had a mouth on me. That was that was my defense mechanism, hoping that what I say to you would keep you from trying to beat me up at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. So the teacher would let me leave to go home. She'd give me a 5-minute head start. She knew these kids were going to be chasing me home.
Oh no. But you knew the smart was going to give you opportunities.
I didn't know that was going to give me opportunities or not. I knew that I liked being smart and I liked being recognized for being smart. But I did have one challenge where I stuttered. I was a stutterer. And the teachers used to make us read aloud in class back then. I'm 69 years old. I'll be 70 in August. So back then was in the late 60s. Mid 60s. And so they would make you read in class. And she would always start in the back of the room. So I would count and you had to read a paragraph. So I would count the paragraphs to figure out which paragraph I was going to have to read. Because I would go through it in my mind over and over and over again. So by the time she got to me, I could get it out. And I hated paragraphs that began with a word that began with a letter L. I just couldn't get it out. So if that happened to be the case, I would mouth it to myself before she got to me, and I would be sweating and she'd get to me and I would just hope and pray that I could get out the first word. If I get out the first word, I was good. But if not, I was going to have a serious problem. So I was smart, but I stuttered and I was bullied, and but I could run fast, and which is why I ended up making the U.S. track team several years later. But it got me home safe.
It struck me reading the book when I was reading about your background as a professional athlete. It struck me that you couldn't have been more prepared for the situation that you found yourself in. But we'll get more into that. For the many situations that you find yourself in, they're cumulative. Your career has been, and life, it seems to have been cumulative. We have the benefit of hindsight now. You seem pretty fearless. You talk about taking on the Soccer Federation. You were fearless. And you seem pretty fearless about being in the eye of a storm. So what, aside from running home from the nasty kids, what prepared you for that?
I think where I grew up and the circumstances I grew up in, my parents were, and my mother worked in a factory for 40 years. My mother was smart too, but my dad was a really bright guy who, black man in the early 50s, a veteran from World War II, not able to pursue his dreams and ended up working three jobs. When he was in the Air Force, he wanted to fly. but they wouldn't send him to flight school. So they sent him to chef school. So he learned how to cook. So when he got out, he tried to get a job as a cook. He couldn't. So he ended up working in the same factory with my mother for 18 years. And then I'll never forget the day he decided, I'm not doing that anymore. He quit. My mother was livid, but that's how it was. And he ended up spending the rest of his life working three jobs. He would cook at two small, sophisticated restaurants, and then he was a bartender. And that was it. So he lived his life in frustration. So we lived in a very tense community. So you had to be fearless to exist. But I was aware of the fact that I could never walk around where I lived looking like I was afraid of anything, because then you'd be prey. You just couldn't allow yourself to be prey. So I've always been fearless, even though I might have been able to defend myself, but I was fearless.
You had the Black Panthers take over at one point as well.
That's right. Exactly. That was quite a thing.
Yeah, you describe in the book being shot at in the house and you and your mom hiding. Yes. And then the next morning waking up and seeing gun holes through the...
Three bullet holes, three slugs in our front door. Unnerving to say the least, but that's where we lived. And that situation went on for a couple of weeks where we were basically in a war zone where the city would come around during the day and put the streetlights back in. And right after they did that, the Panthers would go around and shoot the lights out so that it would be dark at night in the neighborhood so the police wouldn't come into the neighborhood. And they didn't. But that one night when the police, they were chasing a car, and I'll never forget, I can still hear it now, speeding and racing toward our tenement house that we lived in. And the car crashed through the fence, ended up in the little backyard, and that the police shot at the suspect when he got out of the car to run. And that's how the bullet holes ended up in our front door. But that's what I grew up in, and I didn't know any different really until I went to college. And I went to Dartmouth, if you can believe that, to be transported from New Bedford, Massachusetts, in the Black community with a whole lot of nothing, and then being dropped off at the back of my dorm by my parents in Hanover, New Hampshire at Dartmouth in June of 1972 was quite a transition, to say the least.
Yeah. Now, is that where you started to get involved in track and field? Because you were a two-time NCAA Division I All-American.
Amazing. That's right. That is correct.
And you competed internationally as a member of the United States track and field team as well. So when did you decide to pursue law?
I did an externship in East Palo Alto in the Ravenswood School District. And back then, Palo Alto and East Palo Alto were separated by a highway, 101. They still are. But East Palo Alto was the ghetto, no question about it. And it was a different world. So as a consultant in that summer, they were asking me to help them resolve a problem they were having. And the problem was that the rich suburbs around Palo Alto, Atherton, Menlo Park, were annexing themselves from the property tax rolls that were being utilized to fund education in East Palo Alto. So they brought me in to consult to figure out how to resolve the problem. And I figured out in pretty short order that an educator, a doctor of education, was not going to solve that problem. The problem was going to be solved by a lawyer or a judge in the courts. And the remedy was going to be handed down by a judge or a lawyer who knew nothing about the business of education. And if I was the superintendent of schools, I was going to have to implement this ridiculous policy put forth on my plate by someone who didn't know anything about education. So that's when I started to think, maybe I need to be a lawyer instead of an educator.
Yeah, and you have represented NFL Hall of Famer wide receiver James Lofton, Olympic champions Edwin Moses, Marion Jones, which is incredible, right?
Just talked to Marion yesterday. Yeah.
And then the reason that we're here today to speak about your book, but Hope Solo and the women's soccer team. So tell me a little bit about how you found yourself the representative of that team, and then what the story of the book is about.
In December of 2012, December 13th, in fact, I'm a dates guy. I remember dates and times. I got a call from an associate of mine. His name was Andre. He was Hope Solo and her husband, Jeremy Stevens, financial advisor. And I'd known Andre for years. He would come to the Sports Lawyers Association conference every year, and that's where I met him. So he called me and said, "Hey, Rich, I represent Hope Solo, and the team is in the midst of negotiating their collective bargaining agreement with U.S. Soccer. Hope is the leader of the team, and she's very upset because their current counsel doesn't agree with their salary demands and refusing to take their salary demands back to the U.S. Soccer Federation. So she asked me if I knew of a lawyer who was tough and strong and smart, who would be willing to work with us to get them what they wanted. And I told her about you. And I said, oh, okay, I appreciate that. And would you be willing to talk to her? I said, yeah, sure. Set up the call. He said, well, I've got her on the line right now. So he patched Hope in. I had never talked to Hope before. I knew who she was, but I'd never talked to her. The only time I had any exposure to Hope Solo was back in 2008. She did an interview with Piers Morgan on CNN. Mm-hmm. And it was after Hope had basically had a riff with her coach, Greg Ryan, who had pulled her out of a, I guess it was a World Cup game. And they ended up losing the game 4-0. And Hope made the bold comments afterwards that if she had been in the game, they wouldn't have lost the game, that kind of thing. So I remember watching her and I thought, wow, she's really smart and brave, a little rough around the edges, but wow, I really respect her honesty and her willingness to come out and tell it like it is. Mm-hmm. So when I got her on the phone, I hear this very soft voice and I'm thinking, is this really Hope Solo? It's not the Hope Solo
who was interviewing. Yeah.
But it was her. And she explained the situation and she said, would you be willing to help us, Rich? I said, sure. Yeah, absolutely. I said, what's the next step? She said, are you willing to get on a conference call tomorrow with the team? Sure. So I did. They talked me through the situation. Would you be willing to come to Boca Raton the next day and meet with us in person? I did. And at the time I had a law partner of mine who went with me. And we listened to them and we gave them a little presentation on what we thought we would do or they should do and how we could help them. And when we left the meeting, we're on the way to the airport and the team took a vote to either replace their current counsel or hire. At the time, it was going to be two of us. And they voted 9-9. It was a tie. And so Hope called me on the way to the airport. She says, 9-9. I'm really upset. Blah. We're going to take another vote and well, I'll call you back. So she called me back the next morning. And they had taken another vote and it was 10-8 to keep their current counsel. So I said, hey, not a problem. I'm around. If you want to pass something by me, just give me a call and I'm willing to talk to you. So she said, okay, fine. So that was in December of 2012. 13 months later in January of 2014, I got a call from Hope and she told me, hey, Rich, it's been a year. We signed this MOU, this Memorandum of Understanding, which was basically an agreement to agree. It really wasn't the CBA. But we're unhappy. U.S. Soccer hasn't lived up to their obligations as usual. Would you be willing to meet with us and talk with us? Sure. So I met with the team, talked with them again, told them what I thought they needed to do. And I told them, I said, look, you have to understand that your life as a professional athlete is very short and you have to maximize your potential to earn money. And the only way you're going to do it is to be in control of your circumstance. And you just need to take control, period. And if you bring me on, I can help you do that. So they liked it and said they were going to do it. But months went by, maybe 6 months went by before I heard from them again. So I heard from them again in June of 2014. Yes, they want to bring me on, but they Abby Wambach and Christy Rampone, who were the captains of the team at the time, wanted to talk to me again. So I had a call with, actually it ended up only being Abby Wambach who talked with me in February. We had a 30-minute conversation and they decided, okay, we really like you. We're going to sign you up. But they didn't. So now we get to September of 2014.
Oh my God.
Hope called me and said, would you be willing to fly to Rochester, New York and meet with us again? This will be the third time. And I'm sorry, but we're gonna, the team is kind of decisive, blah, blah, blah. I said, no problem. So I went to Rochester, New York, and I met with them again for the third time. And that was the time when they took a vote and decided, okay, I'm going to bring Rich on and dismiss our previous counsel. What I didn't know at the time when I met with them that day was that they had just met with the previous counsel and Sunil Gulati, the president of U.S. Soccer. And the team had decided that their counsel and Sunil, over a 14-year period of time, had become basically too chummy and too friendly to the extent that the team didn't feel like, his name was John, that John was representing their interests, wasn't advocating for them as vociferously as he could or should. Those two, Sunil and John, had met with the team just before they met with me. I didn't know that they really wanted me because they felt that I would really, you know, represent
them. Yeah. Yeah, I write in the book about the gentlemen's agreements that they had that weren't even contractual, about the fact that the women had no maternity leave. They were flying in coach to games. The soccer fields weren't checked. There was no post career benefit at all. There's no 401k. There's no nothing. And that the men's team ranked 24th in the world, versus the women's team, ranked number one,
right,
in the world, netting $5 million in ticket sales, and the men losing $1 million, and the women aren't being paid equally. So, you know, there's so many things you took into consideration here, and so many tactics I thought were interesting in your book. But one of the first ones, and it sounds like, again, given this long trajectory to being hired, was creating unity among the team Absolutely. Members, right? And then Absolutely. Teaching them to leverage the power of no.
Yes, absolutely.
So I'm curious, how were you able to build unity for them? And when they're, understandably, their income is at stake, at the same token, it's like the discrepancies are so egregious. So it seems to me like, why wouldn't you get on board that bandwagon? But I'm not there. I'm not living in that moment. So I don't know.
I think a few things had happened to the team over the years since the 1999 team won the World Cup. And that's really when the battle for equal pay began, was back then. And they got tremendous pushback from the Federation, even back then. But I think there was always this mentality that if we continue to win and we continue to do well, the Federation will come around and treat us fairly. They really will. We believe that they will. Why wouldn't they? How come they're treating us this way? It can't last. So by the time I got there, in that last meeting in September of 2014, before they signed me up, I told them, I said, look, if you bring me on, I'm only as powerful as the power that you give me. And the power that you can give me, that you're going to have to give me in order for me to get you what you need and want, is unity. There's 24 of you. It's got to be 24 to zip. The vote's always got to be 24 to nothing. Otherwise, I don't have the power.
Yeah.
There can't be any dissenters at all, ever, in all this stuff that we're going to try to do, because we're going to be pushing boulders aside. So there can't be a crack in the armor. You can't give U.S. soccer any notion that there's weakness or vulnerability in what we're trying to do. And a 23-1 vote on something is exactly that. Vulnerability, no unity. Unity is power. Power will get you leverage. Leverage will help us get what we want. Period. It's just that simple. So they understood that. But it took the first year. It took the year 2015, certainly the first 6 months of 2015, for them to understand the power of no. When I took over in January 2015, I began saying no to the Federation almost immediately. The first sponsorship deal they came to us with was the FIFA 2016 video game with EA Sports. And the general counsel said, hey, Rich, this is a great opportunity. EA Sports wants to feature the women's team in FIFA 2016. It's going to be a renewal of the men's FIFA 2012 game. I said, hey, it sounds great. How much are they going to pay the team? Oh, nothing.
Searing. Zero. My head nearly exploded when I read that in the book. I was like, what are you talking about? That's the license of their image. Right. And if, as a producer in entertainment, that's a whole business model in and of itself. Forget the sports, right? The licensing of the image, but that they would think they could get away with paying nothing.
I said to her, name was Lisa Levine, general counsel. Lisa, nothing? What are you talking about? Oh, this is a great opportunity. It's a great awareness and marketing opportunity for the team. And I said, this team, they're perennial Olympic champions. They've won, at the time, it was 2 World Cups. They don't need any awareness or visibility. They already are. It's the men's team that needs that kind of help. We don't need that. And we're not doing it for nothing. Well, you have to. No, we don't have to do anything.
Right.
We don't have to do anything. And we're not doing it for nothing, period. Oh, but we've already negotiated the deal. We're far down the line. The storyboards are already marked up. One of the women on the team are going to be featured on the cover of the game. I said, I don't care. We're not doing it for nothing.
No.
I'll take it back to the team. I have to, and see what they say, but I'm telling you what they're going to say. They're not doing it for nothing. And that's what the team said. We're not doing it for nothing. So when the Federation realized that these women were not going to show up, but the Federation had already contractually agreed with EA Sports that the women would be available to participate, the Federation realized they were going to have to come up with something. So Lisa Levine called me back one day and she said, Rich, just be straight with you. You've already made the commitments for the women to participate in this game. We're kind of stuck. So I'm basically
too bad. Too bad for you. Yeah. Too bad you're stuck. Anyway, stuck. Sorry. Yeah.
We're all family here. The whole family discussion. So we can offer you 20,000. We can offer the team 20 grand, one-time payment.
Total for 24 women.
Yeah. The men are only getting 120,000 a year. It's a renewal of their deal before where they got 120,000 a year. It's a good faith gesture on the Federation's part. We understand where you're coming from, blah, blah, blah. So I said, let me take it back to the team. So I took it back to the team and I said, look, let's do it. They understand now that, or I thought they did, that we're not taking no money to do anything. So this would be 20,000 more than we had, but they got the message. They've gotten the message. So the team agreed. So between January of 2015 and April of 2015, the Federation presented three or four more deals like that to us, which paid little to no money at all. And we rejected them all. And that kind of set the stage for going to the World Cup, winning the World Cup, and then having real leverage to get what the women wanted. The first opportunity to do that was, I wrote about it in the book, when the team won the World Cup and two captains of the team, Christy Rampone and Abby Wambach, literally asked the president of the Federation for the next weekend off.
Off, yeah.
And it was the first weekend after the World Cup, after a 30-day grueling World Cup competition. They were mentally and physically fatigued. They just wanted a weekend off. And they were told pretty point blank, no, we've already marketed the team for the NWSL games this weekend. They're all sold out based upon the fact that national team World Cup champion players are going to play. And no, you're going to play. So they went back to him the next day and he basically said no. And then I'm going to have a call with the entire team and make sure you all understand you're all going to play this weekend. So that's when they finally called me and said, this is what's transpired over the last 2 days. I said, well, a couple of things. One, you're not having any call with the Federation tomorrow night, which was going to be a Wednesday night. I'll have the call. And if you don't want to play this weekend, you're not playing this weekend. Period. End of story.
What's so interesting, again, one of those other tactics, you talk about words being weapons. No, again, now that started young for you, but law, the use of the law. And so what struck me is, again, these off the record gentlemen's agreements, the fact that they, from 2012 onward, did not have a formal contract, that they're operating on a memorandum that doesn't include, again, any kind of licensing terms, any kind of benefits, basic benefits. And then the bringing in the Equal Pay Act. You made a big national morning show announcement. So tell me a little bit about the choice to go to that legislation.
So we pushed back in July after the World Cup and basically told the Federation we're not playing this weekend. And they heard us and we negotiated a compromise where the players would make personal appearances at those NWSL games that weekend after the World Cup final, but they wouldn't play in exchange for some money. So we got some money. They only had to make appearances and didn't have to play. That's what they wanted to do. So with that, we had a victory. With that, that was the first time we used the World Cup championship leverage to get what the players wanted. So from that point forward, I knew that we had the leverage required to pursue this equal pay opportunity in the next collective bargaining negotiation.
You call it a nuclear bomb, too. You call it, and strategically, it was a nuclear bomb for you.
Right. Yeah, it was. It was. Because I don't think they were expecting it, and they weren't expecting it to come from a team that now had some leverage to really push the issue to get what they wanted. So that's what we did in January of 2016. What I did was in August, a month after the World Cup victory, a month after we pushed back and didn't play those NWSL games, I met with Sunil Gulati, the president of the Federation. I said, hey, Sunil, look, that MOU has no marketing provisions. There's no group licensing provisions. There are no provisions in it that allow individual players to market themselves and their brand to make money off of their World Cup victory and probably the next year's Olympic victory. Why don't we negotiate the new collective bargaining agreement, start doing it now so that it can be finished before the Olympics in 2016, so the team and the women can have the benefit of being able to leverage their celebrity and their victories into competent money for them. So he agreed to that, which I was surprised about. This is August of 2015. He agreed to it, but then they dragged their feet and they didn't have the preliminary first meeting with us about CBA negotiations until November 30th of 2015. So we had that initial meeting. We were very transparent about what we were going to ask for. Then we spent the month of December, the team, putting together the collective bargaining agreement proposal. And then we presented it to the Federation in early January of 2016 and started physical negotiations for that deal, which was for equal pay and a bunch of other things, group licensing, health benefits, maternity leave,
401k,
catastrophic insurance, all kinds of things that they should have had already. So that's how we got to the negotiation point of a CBA proposal that had equal pay as the driving force of the proposal. And the lesson here is commitment. Be committed. 100%, commitment is, it's binary. You're either committed or you're not. You can't be 80% committed, 60% committed, and expect to achieve your objectives and goals. You got to be 100% committed. And this team, the U.S. National Women's Soccer Team, at the beginning of the equal pay push, they were 100% committed. But they lost two things. They lost unity. That means they lost leverage. And then they lost their commitment, their 100% commitment to equal pay. And they did not get equal pay. That system they agreed to, the pay-to-play system, it's not equal pay. It's the same compensation system that's paying the men's team, but it's not equal pay. And as always, the devil is in the details, especially with the U.S. Soccer Federation. So therefore, you got to maintain your commitment. This team was in the red zone, 20 yards from scoring the equal pay touchdown, but they lost their commitment. And I understand it. I totally understand it. The human condition, survival is a very strong incentive. They chose survival. I get it. But you got to be 100% committed. That's the lesson. If you commit, maintain the commitment. It's going to be stormy. It's going to be hard. It's going to be rocky. You're going to feel pain. You're going to get slimed. You're going to get all this. But if you maintain your commitment, you're going to get to the other end and you're going to get the gold ring. Period.
What's your experience in the way that men and women use power?
A lot of women are afraid to exercise their power. As the team, we were finalizing the collective bargaining proposal with equal pay, and I had the numbers in there with regard to what equal pay would be. One of the players said, "Rich, are we asking for too much money?" And I thought about that, and I thought, wow, there's still this prevailing view that we don't deserve what we should have in terms of compensation. And we're asking for it. I thought, we're not asking for anything. We're demanding it because you deserve it and you should get this money. So there's just, I don't know why, but I've been drawn to strong women like Marion Jones and Hope Solo and others who are in your face demanding it. We want it. We're going to get it. We deserve it. It's mine. Mm-hmm. I'm taking it. And for whatever reason, some women are afraid to do that.
I think it comes with a label, right? It comes. You talk about an aggressive negotiation style, but if women are labeled aggressive, then it's the kiss of death. And we could be speaking quietly and firmly.
Yes.
And it's the kiss of death.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right about that. And men know that. And what really bothered me about this negotiation is that the Federation had three women on the other side of the table.
And that was disgusting to me. Yeah.
And they were the primary mouthpieces during the negotiations against the women's team for equal pay. It blew my mind. Donna Shalala, Catherine Rumler, and the general counsel, Lisa Levine. I don't understand it.
The story, I was like, how could you be a woman on the other? But I do understand how they do it, because there are women so afraid and entrenched in the system and afraid to speak. That's the point of our podcast, is to encourage women to use their voices. I think what's interesting, though, is, again, you're a Black man. You have a Native American mom.
Right.
So you identify as Black. Is that correct?
Yeah. If your dad's Black, you're Black. I've always identified as Black.
Yeah. So I think you talked about, even when you were making the announcements for equal pay, about the optics, not wanting the optics of being a Black lawyer with white women. And that was really confusing to me because I was so glad you were in the 60 Minutes piece. But I think that's powerful. Personally, I feel that's a powerful statement.
So that's a reality that Black lawyers, Black professionals have to accept and live with. It's just a reality for us that whatever we do is summarily discounted. And what I worried about with that was I didn't want, because it was a bold move, serious nuclear bomb. You've got five white, high-profile female players on the World Cup champion U.S. women's national soccer team suing their employer for equal pay and violation of Title VII wage discrimination at the EEOC. That is never happened before, groundbreaking, revolutionary, is setting a stage for other women in the workplace to maybe do the same thing, to have the courage and the bravery to do the same thing. And I worried that if it was me sitting on the set with them on the Today Show, a Black lawyer putting forth this bold move, that it would be discounted as something that I was doing for my benefit and not for the benefit of the team. And it wouldn't have been taken seriously. And I sit here convinced today that it wouldn't have been. It would have been discounted and dismissed. But if Jeff...
It just makes perfect sense to me. See, yeah. For me, it makes perfect sense that you would understand it and that you would actually hear them in a way that, again, they had not been heard.
Right. Exactly. And to a certain extent, even during the across the table negotiations, I felt that I wasn't necessarily being taken seriously. And one of the lawyers on the other side consistently rolled his eyes at me whenever I talked. Mm-hmm. And he did it to me three times in the first session. The fourth time I leaned across the table, I said, man, if you roll your eyes at me again, it'd be the last time you roll your eyes at me. Mm-hmm. But it was a sign of disrespect. It was a sign of, oh, what are you talking about? You're just a Black lawyer. You don't know what you're talking about, blah, blah, blah. That's how I interpreted it. And that's how he meant it. There's no question in my mind about it. You have to be cognizant of that. You have to take action based on that. It can't be about you. And that's why it's funny. I didn't tell Jeffrey Kessler that he was going to sit on the set until 20 minutes before. And he's like, why not you? I said, hey, trust me. Just go out there with him. One, he's Jeffrey Kessler. He's the preeminent sports lawyer in the world. Tom Brady's lawyer, whole nine yards. He's going to be taken very seriously. And he was. It was.
You talked about the eye of the storm and some of the things that you mentioned, like that it was the perfect storm, that so many things were the perfect storm. And we're seeing it again right now with the WNBA stuff as well playing out. Intuition is something you mentioned. Desire is something you mentioned. Those seem like very feminine leadership. And I'm curious, we talked about power. Do you think women lead differently? And if so, how?
Yeah, I think women do lead differently. And when they decide to take the lead, they're very good at it. Very good at it. In fact, I prefer working with women because women are very directed. They know what their objective is. Ego doesn't get in the way. Men, ego is always the first thing. And women execute. They get it done. That's how my mother was. You know, she's passively aggressive. You know, we had nothing, but she made sure that what we did have, we had it. And we had it all the time, notwithstanding the obstacles that were in her way. She executed. She got it done. I didn't realize that I was absorbing that at the time. But as I look back on it, that's what I saw in my mom, who had little to nothing but herself, her intuition, her strength, her ability to make decisions, and her ability to control the household. My mother controlled our household. So once a woman decides that she's going to lead, beware, because she's not giving up. And men don't know how to deal with that.
The Paychecks Fairness Act, which expands on provisions in the Equal Pay Act, and that makes it illegal for employers to name men and women unequal ages for performing the same work, has been introduced 13 times over two decades, and it still has not passed. So what do you think we need to do if we can make this whole lesson that you've learned actionable? What do we think we need to do to tip the balance?
You need a Hillary Clinton to be the president of the United States. That's what it boils down to. And that's why she's not the president of the United States, because the men, the Republicans pulled out all stops to make sure that she didn't assume that role. And unfortunately, women didn't vote for her either. 53% of the suburban women voted for Donald Trump.
They abandoned ship. Yeah.
And we're still looking at that probability today as we speak.
Oh, yeah. We're seeing it with abortion. We're seeing it in so many areas that women, again, this fear, this pervasive cultural discrediting of our value, our belief that we don't deserve to be paid. We're winning the World Cup. We're winning the Olympics. And right. We still don't. Is it too much? Am I being paid too much? Really?
I think men single out women like Hope Solo and others who are strong and forceful and in your face and eliminate them. And that's the message that they're sending to the rest of the world. If you get out there and you put your career and your life on the line, we're going to take it. We're going to take it. That's what's going to happen to you. And that's why that's why the U.S. Soccer Federation fired Hope in August of 2016. They claimed it was because she called the Swedes cowards. That wasn't the case. How do I know it wasn't the case? Because the coach, Jill Ellis, and Sunil Gulati flew back from Rio with Hope and told her not to worry about it. That was like on the 13th or 14th of August. And then on August 24th, she's fired. It just so happened that it was right about that time when 60 Minutes knocked on their door, U.S. Soccer, and they realized that, wow, 60 Minutes is doing an investigation. So now we have to cut off the head of the leader. We have to cut off the head of the snake, of this the person who's the most forceful on the U.S. women's soccer team for equal pay, and that's Hope Solo. And if we fire Hope Solo,
right,
the greatest of all time goalkeeper, the reason why we've got World Cup and Olympic victories, we'll send a message to the rest of the team that if she can be fired, so can you. So you better get off of this equal pay trip as soon as you possibly can. And that's what happened.
It seems so obvious to me. You're doing the same job. Of course, you should get paid the same. And again, the dollars, there are significant dollars. It's not like they would be broke if they gave somebody a raise. So what do you think it's about?
It's about, and I heard them say it, the men that run the Federation do not believe that the level of competition in the women's league and women's soccer is the same as the level of competition for the men. So they believe that if you are competing in an inferior environment, an environment that's inferior to the men's competitive environment, you don't deserve to be paid what the men get paid. That's what they said. They had the temerity to actually vocalize that. So how do I interpret that? Inherently, they believe that women are inferior.
Well, yes. And that actually makes total sense when you say that, because inferior playing conditions, inferior pay, just as a reflection of their internal value system. Yes.
And what I heard consistently, you women should be happy to be here playing and getting paid. We, the United States Soccer Federation, we have invested more money in your team than any other federation around the world. Be happy, shut up, and play.
That was invest in that team because it's the only one they have that's winning. So they have to do it. That's mindset. Not the logic. I understand.
That's not the logic at all. That's not their mindset. Their logic, in my view, having been with them and listened to the federation, they would rather not have the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, because their focus is the men's team and being a feeder system for the MLS and the pro leagues. That's all they care about. They don't care about the women. They still don't. They still don't. And still don't provide women respect.
Why is it that you like to represent women? Why are you drawn to the stories and to the support and to be an ally of women? Because, what do you think that is?
Because I believe that women are stronger, have stronger constitutions than men. Women, when women are committed to something, it gets done. Women do the work.
What is your wish for every woman?
That women take stock and don't listen to all this noise out here that's constantly telling you, either verbally, overtly, covertly, that you aren't worth it. Forget all that. You're more than worth it. You're stronger than the rest of these clowns out here. Just focus on you, your objectives, and get it done, notwithstanding all the obstacles that men are going to put out there for you. Period. Just keep going and you'll get there. It's going to be hard, but you got to keep going. Otherwise, you're not going to be in control of your destiny. But you've got what it takes. It's in there. And the men know it and they're afraid of you. Force them to face their fears, and their fear is you. Force them to face it.
Be visible. Use your voice. Every other woman needs you to lead. Voice Lessons is co-produced, written, and spoken by me, Kim Cutable. It's also co-produced and edited by Sergio Miranda. You can find past episodes, show notes, and the cool stuff our guests recommend at voicelessonspodcast.com.